Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. It is October 11th, 2016. The first thing I want to do is thank everybody for their support in my time of struggle. There's been a great response to my appeal. As difficult as it was to make, it's been tremendous to know that I have people who are willing to sacrifice on my behalf. I'm not really used to that, and for a long time I had no idea that anyone really listened. And it's really only been recently that I realize how high my numbers are. This is an ongoing struggle. If you haven't donated to me, I ask please that you give something. Although I certainly understand if you don't. This is a temporary situation, and once I'm on my feet again, all of these kinds of appeals will go. But you know, this is what we do. I did it myself when I had money, and this is how a community functions. But it's more. I mean, the financial support has been, you know, has been very, very useful. But the most heartwarming part is that people are willing to sacrifice. We're not living in a rational economy, and so to give money to anyone is really a great sacrifice. And I thank you. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. I want to say something else too. I have a lot of people, all walks of life, contacting me either through Facebook or email about the faith, about Russian history, or anything in between the two. I'm open to any of these kind of discussions. If I have a lot of people now, friends of mine on Facebook, in the process of converting to Orthodoxy, and they're using me as their resource, you know, for better or for worse. And I'm always open to that. I remember when I was younger, and I would write to scholars and people who I admired. It always felt like I was bothering them, you know, like I was an irritant to them, and I hated it. They have no right to do that. Let me assure you, if you are truly a seeker, or if you simply have questions, I really, you know, anybody who would reject that, or you know, give you just a very brief period of time, or not find you worth answering, is needs to find another job. This is very common in academia, where your professors, if you're not paying them, you know, if you're not in the class, they have no time for you. And there's always been the case that, you know, and I'm still getting these. I'm getting a lot of letters. I'm getting a lot of people asking me about different things, especially coming into the faith, and they seem to be apologetic. And I said, you know, this is what I do. This is my whole world. You know, I'm not good at anything else. Well, I make very attractive babies. But other than that, I'm completely useless to the world. So this is what I do. And I always, give that away for free. Always. I mean, you know. But I couldn't get during, remember the middle of the divorce and one of the custody issues. One of the many lawyers I fired was charging me for answering emails. Minimum of $25. And it actually went up, depending on how complicated it was. And I said, are you kidding? Answering an email? I said, I answer emails for people who support me all the time and don't charge them a dime. Answering emails doesn't take any work. What's the matter with you? But that's normal business practice for these people. Lawyers charge rents, especially, not that this is relevant, but criminal defense attorney. I mean, people go into divorce lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, and they're scared. They're upset. They really don't know how the system works. They think that their opponent can use some kind of voodoo to destroy them. And they're very scared and anxious, and they'll pay anything. you get arrested for a crime, for example, you've never been in trouble before, you go to a defense attorney as, you know, almost a guru, and you pay anything to get out of trouble. You'll pay a divorce lawyer anything to avoid losing everything, losing the kid. And it's that desperation. I mean, all bets are off in that particular state. So we're not talking about market values here. We're talking about a market value plus the premium they charge for your panic. And it didn't occur to me, it didn't dawn on me until I was actually in the middle of it, that that's what they do. For the most part, in my experience, we're talking about, you know, central Pennsylvania. The average retainer is $5,000. And of course, they take money from there. I know my ex's attorney was charging her for the most ridiculous things. Things that took me 2 minutes to do myself, she was being charged for. Now, in her case, her father was paying for it. But, you know, they're outrageous. But there may be a market value there, but rent is charged on top of it. Remember, one of the central concepts in political economy, especially these days, is the idea of a rent. A rent is any money that's extracted from the population or any group of people for a non-economic reason, like your panic. You charge extra because the person's in a position where they'll pay anything to get out of trouble. So really, you could pretty much name your price. Charging a rent is the very definition of corruption. So usually in governments, bribery is a form of rent. They're extracting resources, not because there's any economic exchange, but because the person who you're bribing has a position of power. And so you're buying access. That's not very different from the retainers that are out there and that I paid myself. And then, of course, the expense accounts are laughably padded. And it's really hard to go after a lawyer. Number one, you don't want to anger them because they're supposed to be on your side. And number two, they're lawyers. Getting one lawyer to sue another is very difficult. It's like getting a doctor to testify against another malpractice suit. They have to be rivals first. So it's a cult. And I see lawyers seen as a kind of a priesthood that you need their intercession to gain access to the halls of justice. And I think that's how they're viewed. And in times of great stress and great panic, they jack up the prices. And that's a completely immoral form of rent. I mean, rents, by definition, are immoral. Usually the terms like corruption referring to rent, any kind of rent. And so that makes the situation worse. And I'm reading the account that my lawyers has sent me, this is 2.5 years ago, 2 years ago, and I can't believe the things they charged me for. A phone conversation, 5 minutes, $100. I said, how do you live with yourself? You know, so I ended up going through a whole bunch of them. It's very, very expensive, and really was agonizing. Now, speaking of rents, I want to talk about something that occurred in between, so really in 2014, around the time where, 2012 is when the Orthodox Nationalists took a hiatus. That's when everything in my life began to fall apart. I simply didn't have the energy or the motivation or the clarity of thought to do this. It came to a head in 2014, but something else came to a head in 2014. And that was the situation in Ukraine. You go to my website, rusjournal.com, R-U-S journal. You'll see that I make the statement that the events in eastern Ukraine from 2013 to now is one of the most, that they are one of the, some of the most significant and powerful events in world history since the fall of the USSR, which is a tremendous claim to make. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the breakaway republics that form New Russia, Donetsk and Luhansk, and why they came into existence. And not merely that, but what they teach us and what the ideologies of these republics are. And that occurs right in the middle of my personal problems. And my phone is ringing off the hook, people getting my opinion, and frankly, I wasn't taking the calls. So the timing, Yanukovych in Ukraine and myself, we have that in common. You know, things really came to a head in 2014. All my listeners know that starting in 2013, early 2014, riots erupted in Kiev. Now, there was a time that I was very interested personally, and I should say academically, in police government responses to riots. I almost actually did my dissertation on something completely, you know, off my normal interest, and riot police techniques comparing Northern Ireland to South Korea, where they have, you know, police units that do this stuff 24 hours a day. You know, they don't do anything else. There are more riots in Northern Ireland and in South Korea than any other part of the industrialized world. In South Korea, it's a first world economy, and yet there's 180 riots a year. I've been fascinated how the police have responded, different tactics that they've used, the idiocy of it. You know, rioting doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Attacking a police officer because an elite politician in another country forces a trade deal on you doesn't make sense. That's like screaming at the waitress because your food is cold. She didn't cook it. The police are probably just as angry as you are. Taking it out on them is a very bad, you know, it doesn't make sense. But I noticed in Ukraine that the rioters were very violent, more than normal. I have never seen rioters this vicious before. I also never saw a police response so anemic before. I couldn't make sense out of it. There was one scene where these poor riot policemen were charged with a huge front loader tractor was sent after them. They were behind concrete barriers, and there were like three or four lines of them. And this is what they sent to go and break the barriers. I had never seen anything like that before. I was also very surprised that no one shot the driver. When a policeman's life is in danger, when there's a clear and imminent danger of his being killed, he has every right to kill the attacker. That goes for anybody, not just policemen, especially when they're protecting the Capitol. As it turns out, some of you may know that the American embassy was giving away, not just Victoria Nuland or John McCain, they were all involved in this, giving away shots of something called Captagon, which is a very powerful stimulant. It's a stimulant as well as a painkiller. So a rioter can riot for 24 hours and not feel the pain of what a policeman would do to a normal rioter in that situation. It also leads to, especially after a few days, it leads to paranoia and sometimes hallucinations. Then it all made sense because the behavior of the rioters was more vicious than I had ever seen. Now, I'm watching this unfold, 2014, and nothing, as always, nothing is making sense. You guys know that I have discovered a great law of international affairs named after myself, Johnson's Law. It states the following, that the more obscure the country, the better chance there is that the media is simply totally wrong in what they're reporting. There's simply too few experts to tell them any different. More than that, though, if you want to lie about an obscure country, it's much, much easier. So the chances of a reporter or an academic simply lying, making something up, is much higher than if they were reporting something that's happening down the street that you could actually verify. So I formulated this law when I was doing research on Burma. And some of the things that they were accusing the Burmese army of were so absurd and self-destructive that I didn't believe them. If they don't make sense, they're not true. And then, of course, it occurred to me, who's going to tell them otherwise? How many experts in Burma are there in America? that have enough power to go and confront, you know, a reporter who tells a story about something that the army does over there. So Johnson's Law is actually, it's tongue-in-cheek, but it is very serious too. It's not just that because of the country's obscurity that the chances of error in reporting are very high, but also that reporters realize this, realize there's very few people that can correct them and can play fast and loose with the facts whenever they want to pursue their agenda. The ISIS situation, you know, from day one, I knew that they were phony. I'm seeing headlines that just, you know, they're made up. ISIS butchers babies. It's serious. Not just, this isn't a, I'm not exaggerating to make a point. This is what I've seen. ISIS is selling, you know, sex slaves and then killing them and torturing them in front of their mothers. I mean, this is the thing. This is what I'm seeing. Now, even worse than that, I see that ISIS is threatening Palestine. As if there's not enough proof that ISIS is an American-Israeli created entity. They've threatened every country on earth except Israel. And I'll still go, I will show you the New York Times today, yesterday, the day before, America's war against ISIS. They know that it's not true. They report it anyway. But Johnson's Law was very much in effect with Ukraine. None of these people in Washington Post, the New York Times, very few know a damn thing what's going on over there. They don't know the language. They don't know the culture. And most importantly, they don't know the labels. Now, I've been chided for my support of these two republics that came out of the Civil War there, Donetsk and Luhansk, because they use a lot of Soviet symbols. You'll read some of their proclamations. It's classic National Socialism with a big hammer and sickle on the top. And I'm trying to tell people that the stuff doesn't mean there what it means here. There it means conservative stability. Words like fascist don't mean in Ukraine what they mean in America. The protesters that were protesting the gay pride parade in Kiev a few months ago called that American fascism. The word obviously doesn't mean the same thing. Using a picture of Lenin or Stalin and then having a very, very conservative nationalist proclamation underneath it is not inconsistent there. It would be crazy here. So be very careful with the labels. In many circles in Russia and Ukraine, Stalin and Lenin are seen as not socialists, not Marxists, but Bolsheviks, as a very distinct movement, a movement that had great nationalist potential, especially Stalin. Now, it's not true. I have shown that over and over again. But there's still a tremendous bias towards him there. Given what the countries of Russia and Ukraine went through in the 1990s, which is absolutely traumatic, it would make sense that they would look for really the last stable government, the last government they respected, which would be Stalin. Stalin murdered many millions of people, sometimes on his direct orders, sometimes not. He created a climate of fear. He was no different from Lenin or Trotsky. They were identical. All three of them were identical in terms of policy and tactics. The only difference is that Stalin had a much larger bureaucracy to work with. Lenin first started, you know, the Soviet Union was brand new and they hadn't even consolidated yet. So they were absolutely identical. There was nothing special about Joseph Stalin, and he was probably less visceral in his comments than Trotsky was. So you see the hammer and sickle, you see communist slogans, we hate fascism and stuff. They're not talking about that. Those labels you can't apply there the way you apply them here. That is a great proof that if you're talking with someone who uses labels like that, you know you're dealing with an amateur. Amateurs in my field can go to hell. You know I've railed against them in the past. They do a lot of damage, especially if they're intelligent, because they sound like they know something and they don't. If you remember in the 1990s, American academics, these are people teaching in universities and writing for the big-name newspapers, bringing down six-figure salaries, were referring to the Stalinists as conservatives and Yeltsin as the liberals, creating this whole mythic And anyone who wanted to preserve the USSR was seen as a conservative. That was the labels that American journalists were using. And of course, it made us all laugh. They're the very opposite. I mean, conservatism isn't just the preservation of any old thing. It's adherence to natural law. But over there, the labels don't mean what they mean here. The minute they start referring to, they say something stupid like Yanukovych had snipers shoot into the crowd to stop the rioting, as all the newspapers reported at the time, they're an idiot. Why would he do that? That wouldn't stop the rioting. That would inflame the rioting. Any fool would know that the West would immediately blame him for it. It would make him look awful. Why do that? Assad is being accused of using poison gas. Why? He's winning. He was winning in the first accusation. He would know that the West would immediately blame him and put that on the front page of every newspaper. So why would he do it? Putin was supposed to have killed people using radiation, plutonium, so that the victim can be in front of TV cameras, slowly dying in front of the world. Underneath it says, this is Putin's fault. That makes sense. Of course, these people would never order anything like that. It's completely against their interests. It doesn't make sense. If it doesn't make sense, it isn't true, especially in this world. When this first broke, the American Fox News, everyone else, they didn't. They were using the word Bakut, which is refers to a special police service. They thought it was a place for a while. Then a little bit later, they corrected that. It was a part of Kiev. Then a little bit later, they corrected it. It was a part of a political movement. Then an individual person. Finally, they realized what it was. It took 2 days. The initial reporting was absurd. The other thing about the Ukrainian rioting in 13-14 that was absurd is the alleged cause. The alleged cause was that Ukrainians are so pro-European. That means liberal in our sense of the word. Free markets, liberal democracy, that kind of thing. That when Yanukovych decided he was going to sign a treaty with Russia, the Eurasian Customs Union, they rose up in anger and spontaneously sought to overthrow him and succeeded in doing so. The level of ignorance, Johnson's law is 100% applicable here. The ignorance of making that claim was absolutely astounding for a whole bunch of reasons. Reason number one, no one in the history of politics has ever died for an abstraction. No one dies for free elections. They die to have their faction in power or to protect someone in power. Or to protect themselves. But no one has ever died chanting songs about fair trials. These are procedural abstractions. The minute someone starts using those as causes, they're not telling the truth, or they just don't know. No one cares about elections. They want their person to win, however they have to do it. And number two, this had nothing to do with the European Union. Because any Ukrainian who has ever read a newspaper blamed European institutions, especially the United States, for the complete collapse of the Ukrainian economy and the Russian economy in the 1990s. It was, liberal democracy that was imposed on the old Soviet Union. And as some of us all predicted, Solzhenitsyn included, it led to complete oligarchy. Because those who already had power were able to manipulate the system such that it all benefited them. There's never this point where we're all equal, and so now we could have the free market. Now, the free market is always imposed on a group of people that already are divided in terms of power, already stratified that way. They blame the West for that, the West, and especially the Jews. Now, in Ukraine, remember, condemning the Jews for the economic, or at least in part for the economic destruction of the early 90s, that's day to day. Everybody in the Rada, the parliament, makes that claim. It's very common. It's very mainstream. You would hear it. You would hear it every day there. Things that you can say there, you can never say here. So to think that this had anything to do with supporting and defending the European Union. Number three, as if this isn't bad enough, yet another level of error, and that is Ukraine was in no way capable of becoming a part of the European Union in any way. To be a part of the EU, you have to have an advanced economy, organized in a certain way, a bureaucracy, civil service, and legal system, organized in the Western manner. You can't have very much debt. I mean, you have to have, yeah, you have to have, you know, what we would in America would call normal institutions. But in no way was that the case in Ukraine at the time. It would take trillions and trillions to bring Ukraine up to European Union standards, which actually brings me to the point. The reason that Yanukovych rejected the European Union, the status to approach the European Union, was exactly for that. It would cost Ukraine a fortune. He would have to, essentially what they would say, if you want to become a part of us, you have to remake the country in our image. Everything has to be for sale. Now, in Bulgaria, I've written upon the, on this many times, the EU broke all the rules. They brought Bulgaria into the EU even against all their standards. Bulgaria didn't meet a single standard for EU membership, but it was an emergency measure to keep Bulgaria away from Russia. Bulgaria has oil, and so it was very important that she not be brought into the Russian orbit. And of course, Russia is, generally speaking, very popular there. The first thing that the West did upon bringing them into this, you know, ridiculous, attaching them to, you know, it's like seeing a donkey pull a Lamborghini. It doesn't make any sense. The first thing they did is make sure all the oil flowed to the West. That means Bulgaria was importing fuel and now has nuclear power because all the oil has been sucked out and brought to Western customers. That they knew that total dependency, deindustrialization, to reduce these countries to raw materials exporters, this is what the EU would do, what they have done, what they'll continue to do. So Yanukovych, President Viktor Yanukovych, said no. Rather, he said he was going to sign the Union Treaty with the Customs Union, that is to say, the Eurasian Union, Russia, China, Kazakhstan, etc. There you have tremendous growth. You have no debt. You have a tremendous healthy culture in most of these places. Very different from the European Union. The European Union is dead only in the sense that European countries are dead. They're drowning in debt. They're drowning in unemployment, in drugs, in depression. No one has any confidence in the system. Everyone knows they live under an oligarchy, but they don't know what to replace it with. This is not exactly, you know, what you want to attach yourself to. Some of the same people who will condemn nationalists, talking about our fictitious view of the nation, will then go on television and rhapsodize about European values, which, of course, are always procedural. Free trials, open borders, homosexual rights, these kind of things. So Bulgaria was an exception in that respect. Romania, these places were brought in against all standards to keep them away from Russia. But still, Ukraine had a heavy price tag. Same thing goes for NATO. To bring your military into NATO, you have to be completely compatible with all other NATO countries. That's not going to happen in Ukraine. They'd have to revamp everything. It would cost a fortune. The situation in Ukraine is reducible to this. The way that the Soviet economy was organized, for better or for worse, it was one big machine. That's exactly how Lenin envisioned it. That's how he saw the human body. That's how he saw everything. It's one big machine. Ukraine was a very important part of that big machine. But it wasn't organized. Ukraine itself was organized as a part of a machine, not as an independent country. So when she declared independence, that would be like taking out one of your lungs, believing that it can live on its own. It didn't make any sense there either. everything in that economy was dedicated to being a part of the Soviet Union. So declaring independence seemed irrational at the time. And most people, there was an independence referendum, although that was very quickly, most of the population rejected that later on. So that's the backstory here. Yanukovych was more open to the West than Putin would be. He was not, but being in opposition to the so-called Orange Revolution from 2004, he was more suspicious. The Party of Regions, which he supports, is more of an Eastern movement, although I don't want to overstress the distinction between the Southeast and Western Ukraine. I think I've said this before, but before the war started, the polls suggested that Ukraine as a whole was pro-Russian, that pro-Russian attitudes in the East were like 94%, but in the West, they were like 60%. I don't want to exaggerate the distinctions here. The Ukrainian Autocephalous Church under Filaret, the patriarch, has many, many parishes in the East. Moscow Patriarchate has many parishes in the West. I mean, so I don't want to exaggerate this. There's a thriving Orthodox life in Galicia. It's not just a Uniate area. There's a tendency to overstress those distinctions, to stereotype. Now, that's changed, I think. Russian media is banned in Ukraine. But the most embarrassing thing is that this is the second time Ukrainian nationalists have been fooled. I'm not entirely sure the Ukrainian nationalist movement had anything to do with the events of 2014. Because if you read people like Stepan Bandera, and I have read everything he's ever written, he is very much opposed to the West. These are communitarian nationalists, either Uniate or Orthodox. They believe in the commune. They have nothing to do with the West. There's no possible way that nationalism in Ukraine or anywhere else would ally themselves with their enemies, with the major banking cartels that financed the 2004 movement and the 2014 movement. Not that there isn't good reason to protest, but the people who are organizing the protest are the cause of Ukraine's misery. I've been through this on this show many times. I've written about it many times. Between 1991 and 2001, 75% of the Ukrainian GDP was liquidated. In, I believe it was 94, 93, 70% drop in the value of the hryvnia, the currency, in 1 year. 1998, stock market collapse. 55% from August to October. Well, what really was going on there? Clearly, this isn't a spontaneous revolt. Ukraine is a very large, populous, potentially wealthy country. Ukraine has more people with graduate degrees per capita than any other country on the planet. They were the industrial hub of the Soviet Union. They cannot be permitted to remain in Russian hands. Well, on January 28th, 2015, American banks officially took over Ukraine's debt. The total collapse of the economy in the 90s, the collapse of the currency, the constant attempt to rechannel debate in political terms rather than economic terms, continued. The big politicians were talking about procedural issues in the Rada, largely so to avoid talking about economics. I never understood this tendency. I'm speaking at the American Freedom Union Conference in Allentown on the 22nd of this month, and I'm presenting a paper on Albania in the 90s, in this same era, the same situation. In part, at least in the very beginning, the Ponzi schemes that bankrupted what little money there was left after the fall of communism. It was all done by private speculators. But the population protested the government. This made very little sense to me. You go to the house of the billionaires that created this. What did the government have to do with it? The government was too weak to do much of anything. You see that in America, too, that somehow politicians are seen as all-powerful, especially presidents. You may have to remind people that the president of the United States cannot pass legislation on his own. He can't have a vision for America. That doesn't make sense. He's a law enforcement officer. Now, foreign policy is another matter, but he has to have the Senate on board for that. Westerners, you know, in Western media, sees politicians as all-controlling, but there's a reason for that. It's a mystification. The economy is in the hands of the big banks, the big industrial firms, the big insurance firms. When they do the wrong thing, they know, a lot of them at least, that they're going to be bailed out. It really doesn't matter. When things get bad, they could point to the government and say the economy under Obama is awful. It's his fault. As if Obama controls a prime rate and investment decisions. It's the stupidest prejudice that people have. And in Ukraine, even more than elsewhere, it was a constant misdirection, deliberate misdirection of popular anger to the state that had absolutely nothing to do with what happened in the 90s and what continues to happen. But in 2004, the so-called Orange Revolution, financed by Grzynski and Soros, which they admit freely, forced Yushchenko in power, and the economy then continued its long decline and collapse. So there was egg all over their face. The only problem is they did it again 10 years later with predictable results. The coup that took place in 2014, the vicious attack on police officers that finally forced the breakdown of law and order. They had promised, you know, the population of Ukraine peace and prosperity, and of course they had no intentions of delivering that. First of all, protesting against the state doesn't make any sense, since it was private actors and foreign actors that brought Ukraine to its current situation. But the most embarrassing part for Ukrainians is those who supported, from nationalist for nationalist reasons, the Orange Revolution, which is contradictory just in and of itself, saw their economy collapse after that. But they fell for it again 10 years later with the exact same results. I can only assume they'll fall for it again. Everything that the pro-Russian writers, myself included, were saying, every bit of it came true. The minute the coup took place, fuel prices went through the roof. The medical system collapsed, what little medical system there was. I mean, gas went up 280% in just a few months after this. 2 years ago, 44% salary decrease across the board. 46% inflation. Absolutely no confidence in the economy. An engineer used to make 800 euros a month a few years ago. Now he's down to 75. Being paid in the Ukrainian currency is pretty worthless. Everything remotely profitable about Ukraine was sold off, liquidated, and sent to the West to a handful of bankers to pay debt, except in one place. The economic center of Ukraine is the Donbas, coal mining region, which includes the two republics, Donetsk and Luhansk. When this coup took over, they clearly rejected it. They had supported Yanukovych. I have an article on his political thought floating around. He wasn't perfect, not by a long shot, but he was far better than what took over. Ukraine ceased being an independent country. You know, Poroshenko and his crew have to report to the American embassy every week. I believe it's usually Friday afternoon. Since the U.S. has taken over its debt. The IMF has taken over what little economy is left. It's not an independent country. And it hasn't been. It's like Kosovo. It's a banker protectorate. It's completely privatized. But in the East, those two republics, you had coal mining, you had steel, you had high-tech industries, you had a very different culture. And they would not allow themselves, and the new government, when they took over, appointed a governor to do what they had done everywhere else, to liquidate the economy and ship it overseas. The Easterners said no. Now, one of the oligarchs that controlled Eastern steel for a time, Rino Nakhmetov, not a Russian name, clearly, but also not Jewish, one of the few oligarchs who are. He had supported the Party of Regions for a while. However, he does not support the breakaway republics. Part of the reason for this, the breakaway republics are espousing a fairly sophisticated form of social nationalism as their essential core. Get past all the hammers and sickles, they'll use that. Don't worry about it. It doesn't mean, you know, they're not into gulags. You know, that's not the issue here. It can really blind people to the truth. It's like people who see the word Aryan. They see the word Aryan and they get all scared. They think Himmler's coming to get them. I mean, it's like it has this talismanic power over people. Mato's worth about $7 billion. Like a lot of these guys, he used organized crime to take over. He rules largely by extortion. Again, his whole life essentially one big rent. He is in favor, of course, of the liquidation of much of the capital in the East, but not under the government of New Russia, which he continually opposes. In fact, he has fired workers that support that government. Starting in the spring, 2014, the people of that part of the world, especially steel workers and miners, took up arms. Remember, they still had the draft some years ago, and most of the men there have some military training. They seized police stations, local armories, and they said this is simply not going to happen. The good part of it is that, as most of you know, they won. Very quickly, this group, initially kind of a ragtag group of rebels, defeated the I use the term loosely, Ukrainian army. Just like everything else in Ukraine, the army was meant to be a part of the Soviet system. Since there's been no functional economy in Ukraine for a long time, there's no money for weaponry. Most of what they have is absurdly outdated. And very poor training. Lots of theft and graft. The army is not really much of one. And this is how they were able to win. The attempt to take over the East after the coup, April and May of 2014, were repulsed by locals with guns. And they can do this because the Ukrainian army is in very bad shape. Very quickly, these militia groups became disciplined. The brigade columnists, the Lazar of St. Stephen, the Hungarian volunteers, there's a Serbian Chetnik attachment, there's Cossacks involved. A lot of these guys are veterans, whether it be of Chechnya or even of Afghanistan. These groups became disciplined. They have a tendency to function independently. There's a substantial Russian Orthodox army. That's their actual name, militia in the East. But because their opponent was so badly prepared for this, a ragtag group of rebels could actually win. The Sparta Battalion is pretty much the elite unit there. They have defeated the Ukrainian army in almost every engagement. Today, they're a professional force. Now, The Ukrainian army failed to dislodge them for several reasons. Number one, very low morale. They know what they're fighting for, and they don't want to be a part of it. Number two, the equipment is laughably bad. Number three, a huge amount of desertion. Most of the Ukrainian army sent against the nationalist rebels in the east deserted. And they deserted to Russia. Some of them deserted to the other side, bringing their weapons with them. In the very early days of the resistance, they blocked Ukrainian tanks simply with their bodies. Being civilians, not fully organized into any kind of an army yet, there was very little that could be done. It was a clear popular revolt for a very, very good reason. This was a labor nationalism. Overwhelmingly, the ideology of New Russia is national socialist. You would say we're social nationalist. Russian Orthodox, pro-Russian, but not entirely happy or even wanting to be a part of Russia, but to be closely federated with Russia. When Putin annexed Crimea, which had been demanded by about 94% of the Crimean population, their standard of living immediately doubled because the value of their currency went up. Their pensions, their bank accounts, they had more confidence in the system. China came in and right away began, they're in the process of building several new airports and ports in Crimea. The minute you say that we're going to be a part of the Eurasian Union, they come pouring in. This is a dynamic part of the economy. Russia, China, this is where the future is. European Union can't afford anything. So as of now, I should even say as of the summer of 2014, the so-called Ukrainian army were mercenaries hired by the U.S., usually from Poland, Georgia, or Latvia. Most of the POWs taken by New Russia, Novorossiya, from Georgia. So Putin, there's the referendum in Crimea. Almost 100% voting age involvement in it. 92%, as everyone knew, came into the Russian Federation. Their standard of living immediately increases. So what is the Ukrainian population looking at? They're wishing that they could have this situation. Putin's popularity went through the roof, not only there, but throughout the world. His popularity in the very beginning of the war in the east and the occupation of annexation of the Crimea was over 90%. He is everything that the Western politicians are not. You know, the average Ukrainian is seeing their educational system shut down, the hospital system shut down. There simply isn't the money. Ukraine has no economy. It has no currency of any value at all. Now, an extremely important issue is the mythology of a Russian invasion. It is really unique in history, an invasion that no one has noticed. Russia has not invaded eastern Ukraine, although if they did, it would be legitimate because they're mostly Russian speakers there. U.S. being in Ukraine, it's another matter, but the Russians certainly would have reason to. In fact, the leadership of New Russia is begging them to. Putin has not recognized those two republics yet, and I do chide him for that. He's wrong. Now, the whole mythology of this Russian invasion, World War III may start for this reason, so it's actually kind of important. August of 2014, Battle of Lubavsk, General Ruslan Komchak. Again, knowing full well it's futile, orders an attack on the rebel position there, and as he's ordering the attack, he escapes, goes in the other direction, abandons his troops. The men were leaderless and were surrounded and taken prisoners. He went back to Kiev, needless to say, humiliated, and invented the Russian invasion story. The Russians invaded. I had no choice. The people I was fighting in the east, they weren't guerrillas. They weren't locals. These were Russian regulars. Now, the Red Cross has inspected all of these areas. They had full access to all these areas. There are no Russian soldiers there. There are private contractors there, though. Russian intelligence is involved. Russian advisors are there training. That is certainly true. But Russian regulars are nowhere to be found. Why would Putin do this when the Ukrainian army and these mercenaries are in such bad shape? And they've lost almost every battle. But Kolchak is the origin of the invasion story. His cowardice and stupidity is the reason, is the only thing he came up with. It was reported in Time magazine that very week that Russians had invaded, and they used him as an authority. And as it turns out, Russian intelligence is very, very clear as to what happened. There are no POWs taken by the Ukrainian army that are Russian regulars. No one has ever seen these people invading. There'd be no reason to. There'd be no purpose to it. The Ukrainian army and their American backers have lost. As of now, the army of Novorossiya is, you know, about 45,000. As we speak, they transform themselves very rapidly. Most of their weapons, they're not interchangeable, although they're mostly of Eastern origin. Captured weapons now are all of Western origin because these people are being armed by the West. A huge package of military aid to Ukraine has just been sent, forcibly extracted from the U.S. taxpayer. And John McCain, Hillary Clinton, are calling for an invasion and World War III with Russia over this non-existent invasion of Eastern Ukraine. As if that's sufficient, even if it were true, to have this war over. Obviously, there's much, much more at stake. Russia, new Russia, Syria, China, they're offering a third way to the world. They are not controlled by Rothschild bankers. One of the best things that's ever happened to Russia recently are the sanctions that have been put on them. It made Putin more popular, as if he needed more popularity. And it just meant that he was able to nationalize the capital from held by Westerners and take them over. He took over whole sectors. Sanctions on the financial arena meant that he kicked, and in the process of kicking, the old guard out of the central bank. It will be completely nationalized, if not already. Now, he's not a dictator. He can't just simply shoot these people. Procedures have to be followed. But given the nature of the sanctions, the measures that he has taken strongly suggest that these sectors are being taken over and are being run far more competently than they ever were. The sanctions were very good because it forced a great level of self-sufficiency out of the Russian economy and the Russian population, especially in banking. They're creating their own insurance market, their own bond market, their own banking system under state control and then under the control of the Eurasian Union. This is a third way. Watching the continued civil war unfold is hard to do. Ukrainians are a great people. I believe that they should be an independent country, but very closely aligned with Russia and the customs union. I think they should have a similar situation as Belarus has now. They're a highly intelligent people. They're a central hub of orthodoxy. It's a bit different than orthodoxy from Moscow. There's nothing wrong with that. There's a whole Western right movement there. There's nothing wrong with that either. It is an independent culture most of the time, being under, Ukraine. Most of Ukraine wasn't under Moscow through most of its existence. One of the big and central issues is that a explicitly national socialist movement has founded two independent republics, and even under these conditions, their economy has grown thanks to trade with Russia. They have officially founded a state-controlled central bank, and they use the ruble as their currency. They're not going anywhere. It doesn't matter, whether it be Alexander Zakharenko or Pavel Gubarov. These are all good people. The politicians who are in charge, but they're less important than what they're standing for. All strategic industries are nationalized. Foreign trade is in the hands of the state, as it should be, especially for small countries. They're closely allied with China, as in the Crimean situation, which brings them nothing but benefits. The Donbas area, or I should say, you know, Donetsk as a whole, they have access to the sea. About 7 million people. Donetsk, it's 87% urban, tremendous industrial background. They're a part of the Baltic trade route in the Caucasus, Asia-Europe route, Russia-China route. They're a tremendously strategic location. About 25% of, I mean, prior to the war, about 25% of everything they did in Donetsk went to Russia. Because, you know, their standards, 75%, most of what they did, you know, they were simply a part of the Russian world. Their standards, how they do things are not connected with the West. Western Europe can't afford the things that Western companies buy. What do Ukrainians have that a Western company can't provide? Not agricultural goods, not industrial goods. These things were all part of a much larger, not just the Russian economy, but the Chinese economy now. So to believe that that Ukraine should have been a part of the European Union is laughable. I mean, not merely because the European Union countries are dying, demographically dying, that simply there's too much debt for there to be any recovery. But you know, the plan has been to turn Eastern Europe into a raw materials extracting area. They have more than enough industry in their outsourced plants in Southeast Asia. The Ukrainian army, unfortunately, there's been 2,000 suicides over the last year. There's been 16,000 reported cases of desertion, but those are only those that that have an official government prosecution, that there's an attempt to stop it. In the United States, it's about the same. There's a massive desertion crisis in the U.S. military. Since 2006 in the U.S., there's been between 30 and 40,000 cases of desertion in the military, mostly non-officers, of course. That has not been seen since the Civil War. No one wants to go over and fight these wars. Ukrainian soldiers are patriotic, they're nationalists, they're orthodox. They are not going to shoot other Ukrainians. They're not going to defeat a nationalist movement for the sake of a handful of oligarchs that hate them. And the Ukrainian government, which is just now an extension of the American embassy, their entire policy is to say, you need us to the West, that you need us, therefore give us more aid. You know, let us restructure our debt, and we'll be there to attack Russia. Their role as an anti-Russian force is really the only thing they have to offer. And even in that respect, obviously the bankrupt West soon is going to be sick of writing checks. They've gotten nothing out of their investment in Ukraine, absolutely nothing. Putin has increased in popularity. There has been an entire Slavic revival in the southeast of Russia because of the new Russian phenomenon. These two republics, which are run as strongly nationalist, sort of wartime economies with tremendously high morale. The poor military planning of the Ukrainian army and the U.S., they're killing civilians all over the place, not deliberately, but it's been an absolute disaster. It's been very heartbreaking to watch the complete collapse of the proud, incredible Ukrainian people in their history. They could survive, you know, Hitler and Koch, they could survive Mongols, they could survive Stalin, but they can't survive liberalism. This is because liberalism is a totalitarian, rotten system where capital rules everything, and they're able to distract people by blaming the government for things. That's the nature of liberalism. So this is the situation that we have. Johnson's Law is very important because This is what World War III is going to be based on. We'll deal with the Syrian situation and other issues later. We're running out of time here, but this is absolutely essential for Americans to understand. Anyway, I want to thank my listeners one more time for their generosity. I ask for it to continue, because I continue to struggle. But, you know, my life is an absolute utopia compared to what's going on in many parts of the world. It touches my heart, not only, I mean, we're living in a time of optimism. We have Trump in this country. We have nationalism victorious all over the place, whether it be in Brexit or Hungary. We have Putin's popularity. The defeat of the Ukrainian army by these nationalist rebels, this is huge. And I want to continue to write and to speak on this phenomenon from here on in. It is one of the most significant events since the fall of the Soviet Union. In fact, in my opinion, it is the most significant event since the fall of the Soviet Union, politically speaking, in the world, is this development. So don't worry about the labels or the symbols. Listen to what they're saying. This is where our future is. If you're a liberal supporter of the New World Order, you should be scared. You should be. Your time is coming.
You've been listening to
The Orthodox Nationalist
with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioAryan.com.